What's happening, everybody? Welcome to episode 3 of the brand new Old Man Squad Fantasy Basketball Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Bespris. That part, at least, I don't have to relearn. I'm trying to say it slowly, at least until I can get it to roll off the tongue. This is, of course, a member of the brand spanking new Old Man Squad Sports Network, and of which I am the founder. But not the sole member anymore. My good friend Joe Arrico started 90 Feet From Home, a fantasy baseball podcast that will also be under the same umbrella heading. And we should have at least another show by next week. And I'm hoping a few more in the coming weeks thereafter. It's been a really, really, really fun time for me to see how many people have kind of come out of the woodwork to say that they're interested in being a part of what we're building here. And if you're among them, then come on down. Hit me up on Twitter, at Dan Bespris. That's the easiest way to get me. Of course, you can leave comments on YouTube videos after the fact. You can send an email, I think. No, I don't know if I have a dedicated email address yet. Anyway, work in progress. We're pulling all the pieces together here on this thing. Today, we're going to be diving into the top 10 on the fantasy board, and I continue to struggle with this concept of, do I go back and cover all the things that I've done in the past and try to mash them into a sort of a hyper-expedited timeline simply because, you know, this podcast feed doesn't have those shows on it, or do I keep kind of forging ahead and treat it almost like there was no actual change? This is, I guess it's more of a Matrix thing. There is no spoon. There is no change of pod, even though obviously there was, and just keep going. Like, anybody that was listening to the old one is going to bounce on over to the new one. And I don't know what the right answer is to that question. So I might kind of fluctuate back and forth, and today's show is a little bit more of the just kind of forging ahead. This is a show topic that I wanted to do on the other feed that was in the not-too-distant future, along with, by the way, if you're looking for what's coming up at some point on this feed over the next few weeks, we're going to be breaking down the rest of the Old Man Squad, which is the list of targets that I put out prior to this most recent season. We are going to be breaking down Yahoo's final rankings board and how they did compared to their preseason markers, which, again, a bit complicated because I think we lost the preseason ranks of things at some point. They do that re-ranking mid-season. That's a little screwball, but we'll compare it to ADPs, which don't change at the very least. So that's something. It's like comparing how final ranks compare to what everybody was doing with them. And being that ADPs are largely influenced by the Yahoo pre-rank board. Anyway, there's a certain usefulness to that as well. We're going to be going through teams, so team-by-team review. We've got lessons learned. We've got look-ahead stuff. I mean, it's like silver lining here on starting from scratch is that everything is new, and so I have, like, you know, 300 or 400 shows worth of stuff to do instead of trying to figure out what to do for 150 off-season shows. But anyway, let's get into the stuff, because I know everybody that's joining, if there's one person that's new that's like, what the hell is this dude talking about? I'm finding him for the first time today. Well, welcome. But yeah, it's been an interesting few weeks in the world of Dan Bespris. As far as the top 10 goes, and that's the topic du jour today, there it is. That's your top 10 board, and I think that's about as large as I can make it. If you're watching with us live, I can try to make it a little bit larger, but then it kind of goes off the edges of the screen. So let's we'll leave it at that. Top 10 list, this is by Basketball Monsters per game rank board, is Joel Embiid, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, Nikola Jokic, Anthony Davis, Luka Doncic, Victor Wembanyama, Kawhi Leonard, Donovan Mitchell, Kyrie Irving, and Tyrese Haliburton. And what I'd like to do today is to go through those players one by one, spend a couple minutes on each of them, and just discuss, first of all, how they got there, meaning not like what the year was for them, but we'll touch on that on a few of the guys that had slightly more tumultuous seasons from a missed game standpoint, but really more of the, like, how did the stats get to where they are? And then whether each individual player, and we'll do this while we're working through the board, does it teach us anything about what we can do moving forward? Starting at the top, Joel Embiid had a fantasy per game season for the frickin' ages. 35 points almost. Actually, let's get specific with it. 34.7 points, 1.4 three-pointers, 11 rebounds, 5.6 assists, 1.2 steals, 1.7 blocks, 52.9% from the field, 88.3% on extraordinarily high volume free throw shooting, and 3.8 turnovers. He was hyper elite in scoring, free throw percent. He was quite elite in rebounding, blocks, and sort of field goal percent. Let's just call him very good in field goal percent. He was a positive in assists, certainly for a center, pretty damn elite. And then steals was even a positive for Embiid. Threes was basically a wash, probably a positive for centers, but compared to everybody, kind of a wash. And then turnovers was the only marked negative for Embiid this year. He was way out ahead of everybody else in per-game ranks. The gap between Embiid and Gilgeous-Alexander was notable enough. And this is why we talk about guys at the top of the board being so damn important. But like talking about what Shea had done this year was extraordinary in its own right. And Embiid was like ahead, maybe not and shoulders, ahead in front of SGA. Of course, then, the large issue here that you can't talk about Embiid's season without discussing is that he missed half the damn year. He was banged up in a big way. The knee issue being the largest of it, but not all of it. Those weren't the only games that Embiid missed this season. You knew going into the year that Joel was going to have some kind of games missed situation. It's just, that's who he is. A super successful year for him would have been probably in the mid to high 60s in games played, and obviously he didn't get anywhere near that. He had for two seasons in a row, 68 and then 66 ball games. So taking him near the top of the board was, or at least it felt, a little bit less risky than, say, if you had done it 2 to 3 years ago when he really hadn't played even close to a full season. Like, he hadn't gotten within, oh, geez, I don't think he'd gotten over 80 games played in a year prior to 2021-22. The first five seasons of his career, he just didn't. And then all of a sudden, he missed 14 games, so cleared the 80-game threshold, and then he missed 16 games, which is basically 80% right on the nose. Very close. And you're looking at him, you're like, okay, well, you know, if he can get to 80%, that puts him pretty close to league average in missed games, a little bit below it if you're rolling into this year where games played number was a little bit higher for a lot of guys. But, you know, those last two seasons, he was right on league average, even a tiny bit better in that 68-game year. And you're thinking, okay, well, you know, I know the upside here. I know the risks. I'm going to take Joel Embiid first, second, third overall. And then you pray. Now, the problem, of course, here is that if you're first rounder, it doesn't matter how good they are. If they play half the season, you got no hope. There's just no chance. It's not going to work. He was incredible. Embiid was so good this year, but it doesn't matter. You can't miss half the season. You destroy a team's chances of winning by missing half the season. Listen, it'll surprise you how high he was by totals. He was number 47, by the way. In 39 ball games, he was number 47. So, like, literally every game he played, he was going to jump another, like, 3 to 5 pockets there until he got up into the uppermost crust, and then it's harder to jump places. But, like, the fact that he was still a late fourth rounder in half a year just tells you how incredible he was. Still, you almost definitely weren't winning your league with Joel Embiid, because not only did he miss a lot of the ball games, he missed them during the head-to-head playoffs. And for Roto, as great as it is to get that level of production from someone, you just, like, missing half a season from your lead horse, there's not, I mean, I don't want to say there's no coming back from that, but there's almost no coming back from that. So what's the lesson to learn here from Embiid? The lesson is the guy, and like, look, I know some guys get labeled injury prone that don't deserve it. Some guys get labeled super healthy that don't deserve it. Embiid is a guy who has never played 70 games in a single season. He's been in the NBA for, what, 8 years now? He's never played 70 ball games. Highest is 68. You just kind of have to understand that the risk with him is going to be extraordinary. The upside is out of control high, but you also take your season into your hands with it, especially because it's going to cost you a top three, top five. I mean, I don't know what it's going to be next year. Somewhat, the half season played might push him down the board a tiny bit. But it's going to probably cost you, I would think at lowest, a top five pick, where you could select somebody who maybe doesn't have those health risks, not to that same degree at least, and just assume, you know what, I'm not going to lose my league right now. Well, here's the thing. Coming into this year, I think we all kind of knew that Embiid had a good shot to be the number one per game guy. In fact, I think that was one of my preseason hot takes. I was like, I think Joel Embiid is going to be the number one player in fantasy this season. And he was, per game, not by totals. If you have a top three pick next year, I don't know that you can in good conscience draft him, despite the fact that he's likely to be incredible. And, you know, I don't know if Philly brings in another superstar, so maybe that takes a little bit off his plate. Simply because the chance that he loses you your league is not insignificant. Whereas if we start to move down the board a little bit, like the next player on the list is Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, like there was no way. First of all, Shai's missed games over his career have largely been by design. When they've wanted him to play, he's mostly played. He got to 68 games last year, first couple seasons in the league. He played 82, and then he played 70 out of 72. That was the COVID year with OKC. I believe that was the year where they were actually slightly competitive. And then they tanked for a few seasons. Duh. Then he came back and mostly played last year, 68 out of 82. And this year, 75 out of 82 ballgames. He's not injury prone. They shut him down. It's a very different monster. How did he get to this spot? Well, he just continues to get better. Every year, Shai keeps getting better. And, you know, field goal percent was higher this year. Free throw percent was actually a tiny bit lower this season. But assists were up. Rebounds were up. Turnovers were down, believe it or not. I have every reason to believe that Shai is going to be a top five per game guy again next season. And we also have every reason to believe that he's going to try to play in as many games as humanly possible next year, which I don't think you can say about the dude that finished in front of him in Embiid. Shai was number two, by the way, by totals. He only lost out to Nikola Jokic, who's the next player on the list. And I don't think that we need to go into as much detail on Shai or Jokic, frankly, because these are guys that are going to get drafted in the top three, I would assume, next year. The question, I guess, is where does Victor Wembanyama go? That's probably your top three draft picks next season, unless somebody gets woolly and goes Luka or something like that. I don't think Embiid goes top three with the injury stuff. But like with Jokic and Shai, if you have a top three pick and you end up with those guys, I think you can feel relatively confident that you're going to be okay. Now, admittedly, like, yes, catastrophic injuries happen to everyone. You can't predict that stuff. But Jokic doesn't leave the ground. It's a lot easier to maintain some portion of health when you don't jump. I know it's a simple analysis, but it's freaking true. He's just a bull. And then for Shai, I mean, you know, look, he's not the world's strongest dude, but so far so good. When he actually wants to get out there, he can play most of the ball games. And for the Thunder, they're just getting better every year. So yeah, I mean, you can't predict these things down to a tiny degree of uncertainty, but you can look at those three guys we've talked about and say, look, one of those three guys is a much larger injury risk than the other ones. Could it flip and next year Embiid plays 71 games and Shai gets hurt and misses 25? It certainly could, but the odds suggest that it probably isn't going to be that. Number four player in fantasy this season was Anthony Davis, which is pretty awesome. By the way, I didn't give you guys the numbers for Shai and for Jokic. The numbers for those dudes: Shai, 30.1 points, 1.3 threes, 5.5 rebounds, 6.2 assists, 2 steals, 0.9 blocks, 53.5% from the field. Yes, he was a better field goal percent option than Joel Embiid. 87.4 from the free throw line, also very, very good there. And only 2.2 turnovers, which is pretty awesome for Shea in 9-cat. Jokic, 26.4 points per game, about a three-pointer, 1.1. 12.3 rebounds, which was among the top guys in the NBA. 9 assists for Jokic. That's crazy. 1.4 steals, 0.9 blocks, 58.3 from the field, 81.7 at the foul line, and 3 turnovers. Anthony Davis, so go the free throw percentage with him, because everything else is pretty repeatable for AD. 24.7 points, just under half a three-pointer, 12.6 boards, 3.5 assists, big, big, big defensive numbers. 1.2 steals, 2.3 blocks, 55.6 from the field, 81.6 at the free throw line. That's the big one for AD. For free throws to be a small positive as opposed to kind of a medium negative, that's how he jumps from mid to late first round up into that kind of upper echelon group. Does it happen again next year? I don't know. And can AD play 76 games again next year? I'm inclined to think the answer's probably not, but I honestly don't have any idea. I think something that you saw wasn't necessarily that like everybody wanted to get to the 65-game threshold so that they qualified for awards, because like AD got to 76. That was the Lakers needing Anthony Davis to play in every ballgame, or they wouldn't have been in the upper half of the play-in group. Now, that team might have missed the frickin' playoffs if AD missed another 10 ballgames. They were truly horrible when Anthony Davis didn't play. And that may be the case again next year, although, who knows, like, do the Lakers get a better backup center option? You know, off-season questions to answer as far as how the team goes. But I think he knows, looking at the team, that he's the most important player to them. So I'd expect AD to play next year. I think you're still going to see a lot of fear around his health, and you should, because Anthony Davis goes to the locker room about every other ball game in the middle of the game. A lot of times, luckily, he came back this year, and by all accounts, his health was outstanding. But expecting him to get to 76 games another year sounds like a big, big ask. I am very curious where AD is going to go in drafts next season. It's going to come down to kind of where these guys that finished near him in the ranks go. Like, where does Luka go? Where does Wemby go? Where does, frankly, Joel Embiid go? Where does Tyrese Haliburton go next year? What about Jason Tatum? He was kind of like a consensus mid-first rounder, and he finished at 15. Are there any other guys that jump up the board almost preemptively that could get into that mix? I still think when you look at those names I just listed off, you probably don't see Davis go before like 7th. Count it out. Let's count it out. Embiid probably goes in front of him. Shea, Jokic definitely do. Luka almost definitely does. Wemby almost definitely does. So to me, the earliest you see Anthony Davis go is 6. But then you've got these other guys that were all kind of in that same chunk of players this year that, like, could Tatum go in front of him? Maybe. Could Steph Curry go in front of him? Maybe. Haliburton? Maybe. Kevin Durant? Is in Phoenix? I doubt it. I don't think you see AD go any farther than that. Highly doubt you see LaMelo Ball get drafted in the first round again. And then I don't know who else you could argue is in that mix. So probably somewhere between 7 and 10. If I had to guess where AD goes next season. And honestly, I don't know if I take him at 7. If there's a much safer option out there. Now, the difference between Tatum and Anthony Davis this year on a per-game basis was extraordinarily large. So if that's what you're looking at, but like, what if you're looking at Haliburton versus AD? Before Tyrese got hurt this year, he was a top 5 guy. Then he fell. Next name on the list is Luka Doncic, who finished at number 5 because he finally turned his free throws into not a large negative. His other stats have always been massive, and they just keep getting more and more massive for Luka. This year, 33.9 points per game, second in the NBA there, per game. Actually led the league in overall scoring, I believe. Yeah? No? Missed games might have cost him. 4.1 three-pointers, that's crazy. 9.2 boards, 9.8 assists, 1.4 steals and half a block. Field goal percent of 48.7, so he really didn't hurt you there. And then 78.6 at the foul line, where he did hurt you a little bit, but not much. And then, of course, the very large turnover number, which, I mean, that ain't going anywhere because Luka's putting up these absurd stats. And dude took 23.5 shots per ball game. And I think there's every reason to believe that this is the kind of stuff that repeats itself, unless the Mavericks dramatically change the team makeup. But what else are they really going to do there? Okay. I think I'd be more confident about taking Luka in the top five next year than I was this season, because I hadn't seen him really fix the free throw stroke yet. And there's a possibility that that tapers off again. So, you know, he's still not my favorite guy to take in that range, but he's so good at three categories: mega, super, ultra elite, and then very, very good in rebounds. And, you know, pretty decent in steals. Not like a world beater there. But, like, for head-to-head leagues, Luka Doncic is a wonder, because turnovers you're not really paying super close attention to anyway if you're trying to win the games played battle every week, which moves him even higher up the board. And then you got Wemby. So let's keep going here. Number six this season was Victor Wembanyama. He was top three the second half of the year. And frankly, I think I'd rather show you guys Wemby's stats for basically just the second half of the season, where he was out of control. Final 25 games, Wembanyama, 23.5 points, 2.3 threes, 12 boards, 5.3 assists, 1.5 steals, 4.5 blocks. Goodness gracious me. Bad percentages, though, and very high turnovers. But the blocks were so extraordinary that, you know, you blink two or three times to cartoon noises, blink, 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 and you still can't believe what you're looking at. Wemby's going to get drafted. I mean, he might go first in some leagues, but I feel pretty confident that he's going to be going top three almost everywhere. But I would offer one little note of caution on Wembanyama. Even though, you know, the stat lines that he puts up are so unbelievably fun that, like, you just wear whatever goes with it. Because, like, looking at some of the games he played, some of the lines he was putting up down the stretch this year was just outrageous. I'm thinking of, like, the Philadelphia game on April 7th, 33 points, 18 rebounds, 6 assists, 7 blocks, 5 three-pointers, and he did it on good percentages. He did have 9 turnovers that game. But, like, 2 games before that, he went for 23, 15, and 8 with a steal and 9 blocks. Absurd. Absurd. If he starts to fix the percentages in any kind of meaningful way, well, then fantasy is just broken. Because really the things holding him back, turnovers, which I don't know if those are going anywhere. I mean, Spurs get better around him. That's how you could see those change a bit. Field goal percent, 46.5. And, you know, pretty high volume, especially down the stretch. He was on very high volume because everybody else was down and out. Vassell was out. I think Keldon Johnson was out. Everybody else on that team that was willing to take a shot was hurt. So, you know, Wemby was taking 20 to 30 shots a ball game. And those percentages were putting a dent into things. If he fixes those, I mean, there won't be anything more entertaining in the history of fantasy sports, perhaps, than Victor Wembanyama. But you guys know the way I tend to operate, which is I like to see something happen. Or maybe that's not fair, because if I say I'd like to see something happen, then we're never going to be ahead of the curve on anything. I just like to see some sort of indication that a thing is about to happen. And I didn't see that from Wemby this year. Everything else was insane. Like, the learning curve for him was so much shorter than I ever anticipated. And I don't want it to sound like I'm doubling down on being somewhat doubtful of how fast he can figure things out, because he very much did this year, faster than I expected. I thought he'd be really, really good, like, all-star break on, but he was really good. Like, it took him like a month and a half, 2 months instead of 4. So this guy's a freak in every respect. I think the alien, right? That's the Nike logo that they've built for him. It's very cool, and I love leaning into the branding. But I didn't really see anything down the stretch to make me think that field goal percent, or frankly, free throw percent, was about to just get better. Sometimes it does. Sometimes it's going to be a strength thing. Sometimes it's shot selection, which, I don't know, are they going to force him into different shots next year? Who knows? Some of it's going to be about the team around him getting better when he doesn't have to be such a focal point. But a lot of it is just going to be growth, and anticipating it is a little bit of a coin flip. Now, what are the upsides and downsides to that? If he figures out percentages, again, they don't even have to be great. They just have to be, like, average to slightly better than average. Well, then you've got a top three guy, and it's an easy call. The other thing with Wemby is he does exhibit, because of how good he was in blocks the second half of the season, there is a certain parallel to other guys that have been kind of pooped on because of being one-trick ponies. And I think it's important that we keep one eye on that as well. Now, one of the differences for Wembanyama is, you know, with a guy like Jaren Jackson Jr. in what was the JJJ block number last year? Three. He had three blocks a game, and it was easier for folks to say something, oh, well, he's going to win you blocks by himself. No, but he does sort of take care of the work of like 4 to 4.5 players on your team, which is a huge advantage to have. Wemby at 4.5 blocks per game, which, I mean, I don't know if that's sustainable for an entire season, but in the 4 to 5 blocks per game range, then you almost can say that he can legitimately win you blocks by himself, which seems nuts, but like, we're talking about a guy that could block 300 shots next year. How absolutely crazy is that? Look at your Roto League at the end of the year. Just like, look at the standings in your Roto League and look how many blocks it took to be even mid-pack. Mid-pack in blocks was like 500 to 550 range was mid-pack. Maybe even slightly less than that. Yeah, 500-ish. You're telling me one player can get you 60% of the way there? Woo. So, like, legitimately, he could win you a category by himself. But what's that worth? What if the league adjusts? What if the league stops going at him in the same way? What if you see guys just barrel into him and try to knock him out of the way, and it's not a blocked shot, it's a missed layup, but he doesn't actually get a hand on it? You know, I don't think Wembanyama is going to see the same blocks drop off that someone like a JJJ did. I, you know, he's so unbelievably tall and so unbelievably long that it's going to take the league, I think, a long time to adjust to how absurdly long he is. But adjustments do happen. So what if the blocks come down into the threes, even from the fours? Then you're looking at, and this is basically what Wemby's stats were for the entire season. He was at 3.6 blocks per game, which is still extraordinary, but it's not top two. It's mid-first round. Is taking Victor Wembanyama at two a move that could ruin your team? No, I don't think so. But it's also worth pointing out that, you know, even in the second half of the season, he was really only a positive in blocks, rebounds, and scoring-ish? Nah, a little bit more than that, I guess. But those are the big ones. The assists were a small positive. Steals was a positive as well. But, you know, we're not talking about a guy that was hyper-elite in a whole host of things, the way that, like, a Luka was, or Jokic, or Embiid before he went down. We're talking about elite in rebounding, out of this world on another planet, no one's coming anywhere near him in blocks, pretty darn good in scoring, and then a positive in threes, assists, and steals. This is good, mind you. This is not me knocking him, but this is if you took the 4.5 blocks and you throttled that back down into the threes, what is he? Well, he's very, very good still, but he's not top three. So which way do we think he's going to go? Time will tell. Next name on the list is Kawhi Leonard, who managed to get into 68 ballgames this year, and that's a big win. Big win. No matter how we shake it out. Big win. He was number 7 per game. He was actually number 6 by totals because Joel Embiid fell out of the top 6. Easy math to do there. Kawhi, 23.7 points, 2.1 threes, 6.1 boards, 3.6 assists, 1.6 steals, 0.9 blocks. Always good percentages as they tend to be. And he is the first player we've talked about that's actually a positive in turnovers in that top group at 1.8, just 1.8 per ballgame. So a little bit of a 9-cat lift for Kawhi Leonard, who, of course, finished the damn season with a busted knee. I still love Kawhi Leonard for games cap formats. You could pretty much never talk me off of him there. If anybody saw this season and thought, ooh, this guy's safe to draft in head-to-head, nope. Even as much as I love Kawhi Leonard in fantasy, I don't love him enough to take him on the head-to-head side. We, because we loved Kawhi Leonard this year. As a games cap darling, we got a best case scenario. We got Kawhi doing the usual top 10 per game stuff, which was the expectation, but played in about 8 to 10 more games than we thought. So he went from being, by totals, what would have probably finished near his ADP, near about 22 to 26 range, instead finishing as a mid-first rounder. That's the great scenario. The bad scenario would be if he played in 58 ball games instead of, or 51-ish, 50-51 games instead of our target, which was around 60 to 62. Okay, then it hurts you, but you know you're going to be able to get him probably for a late second, early third, and I don't know that anybody's going to change that, especially with him being hurt down the stretch. Easy one. Number 8 this year, Donovan Mitchell, who missed way more games than Kawhi Leonard, and I have this weird sneaking suspicion that he's going to get drafted ahead of Kawhi next year because people are going to look at it and they're going to say, Kawhi is super injury prone, which fine, you know, a neurodegenerative or a muscular degenerative disease, right? There's an apathy in there. And then with Mitchell, it was just like a whole list of things that never went away. It's a strained calf, it's a hurt quad, it's a back issue, it's a knee issue, it's everything all lined up one after the other. But Donovan Mitchell's had his share of missed ball games here lately also. I don't want this segment to sound like I'm knocking Spida, but he also hasn't played 70 games since the 2018-2019 season. Mind you, he got close a few times, 69 out of 72, so it was pretty damn healthy that penultimate year in, not the penultimate, that was a few years left in Utah, but then 53 out of 70-something, 67 out of 82, 68 out of 82, 55 out of 82. He's not going to get you. He's not getting to 75 ball games. Not anymore. That was a Donovan Mitchell from days gone by. He's not injury prone necessarily, but he is pretty banged up. And so if you're going to draft him, just understand that 68, 69, 70 games is probably the best case scenario for Donovan Mitchell, which mind you, you know, his per game numbers remain excellent. 26.6 points, 5.1 boards, 6.1 assists. That's a career high. 1.8 steals, also a career high. Half a block, a career high. Shooting ball well in Cleveland. Great free throw number. Good three-point number. Volume there. Like, lot to like, certainly, on Donovan Mitchell, but he's going to be a little bit dinged up. So just, I think, be aware that also looking at him, there's no guarantee that the assists, the steals, stay as high as they are. Those are things that could also come down a little bit for Donovan Mitchell. And frankly, I think this, from a per-game standpoint, is probably about as good as it gets. So we'll see where he goes next year. My guess is probably near the same spot as this season, which was kind of in that early second round, like the 13 through 17 range. And that's probably relatively fair, because you're going to get per-game numbers that are that or maybe slightly better, and then you're going to be praying for health. And that's kind of a similar story to the guy right behind him in per-game ranks, which is Kyrie Irving. Also a low turnover guy, so a 9-cat mini bump at 1.8 turnovers per game. 25.5 points for Kyrie, 3 three-pointers, 5 boards, 5.2 assists, 1.3 steals, half a block. A very good, 49.7 from the field for a guard, especially a dude hitting 3 three-pointers a game. That's a big number at field goal percent, much like Luka. Not hurting you in field goal percent while making a ton of threes is a nice luxury. Kyrie very good at the free throw line, but doesn't get there as often as you'd like. And this is kind of what we thought from Kyrie, too. There was no real worry that he was going to take a big hit playing next to Luka, because he's been next to somebody pretty much his entire career, LeBron, Kevin Durant, whatever. So usage was still fine. The issue for Kyrie for all of this time is that he also doesn't play in that many ball games. I felt pretty good about going Kyrie Irving. By the way, and Yahoo had him at 7, so it depends a little bit on what site you're at. I felt pretty good about Kyrie Irving because I thought with his new team here, there'd be a little bit of a push for more, but he was banged up. He missed 24 games this year, and he also hasn't cleared 70 games since 2016. Yeah, oops. Also, obviously had the whole vaccine stuff going on. We don't need to get into that because it's not injury related. But there's just always something with Kyrie. There's no chance he's getting to 70 games anymore. And so if you draft him near the turn, which I was comfortable doing, like Donovan Mitchell, he's a guy you're expecting to beat that mark per game. And then you're just praying for like 64 to 67 games played. If he gets there, then he's a win. And if he doesn't, then it's a loss, and you're sort of counting how many squares behind you are. He finished, by the way, by totals this year at number 27. So it didn't ruin your fantasy team, but he was, by all accounts, a slight downer on the head-to-head side and someone that you probably didn't feel too terrible about by per-game numbers. And then the final name on the board, and before we do Tyrese Haliburton, just want to remind everybody again, there's a lot of you guys that are tuning in live via social media right now. Please take a moment. I don't care about likes on Twitter. I don't need that stuff from you. I don't need retweets from it. I need you guys to please go and subscribe to what I'm doing through some other platform or platforms. And the links are all in the show description. They're all there. So for Twitter, it's hard, but you can go to the pinned tweet. So just go to twitter.com/DanVespris and you go to the pinned tweet. The second one, it's a two tweet or a three tweet pin there, I think. If you go to the second one in that little mini thread, it's got the iTunes link, it's got the Spotify link, it's got the YouTube link, it's got the iHeartRadio link. Please, please, I beg of you, subscribe on as many of those as humanly possible. I really need it right now because this is a time of year where people are not looking for their fantasy basketball podcast. So what I do is not going to rocket to the top of the, whatever you want to call it, like the trending board on social media. It's definitely not going to rocket to the trending board on YouTube because ain't nobody tuned in on YouTube looking for fantasy basketball right now. So what I need you guys to do is help me push it up those things. And, you know, once August, September come around, I think the stuff I'm doing will probably sort of algorithm itself into place. But right now, subscriptions, five-star reviews, whatever you guys can do to help just kind of move things into, I don't mean to be the spotlight, just like a dim, handheld flashlight kind of thing where those folks that are maybe even didn't listen for like 2 weeks and they were like, where the hell is Dan right now? Because they don't hear me on the old feed. You help them find me. That's what I'm asking for. I badly need your assistance with this. And thank you in advance for whatever you could do there. And now let's talk about the last player on today's board. And that is Tyrese Haliburton, who I would argue might be the strangest one to break down in this group. Because Haliburton played in 69 ball games this year. Nice. But also didn't really play in 69 games this year? What the hell's Dan talking about? I'm guessing most of you remember and know exactly what I'm about to reference, which is Haliburton went almost a month in the middle of the year on a strict minutes cap. Haliburton was a force until about January 8th. On January 8th, Haliburton played in 13 and a half minutes and was injured in that ballgame. He came back 11 days later and had 21 and 17. And in that moment, we thought, oh, everything's fine. Nope, because then he missed 11 more days and was never the same. And it felt a bit like he came back too soon and he just wasn't the same guy the whole year after that. He still got plenty of high assist games, but just trying to compare what he did before injury to what he did after, I mean, it is, calling it eye-opening doesn't do it even the tiniest bit of justice. Tyrese Haliburton, the final 37 games this year, which is basically like from injury on, he averaged 17.7 points and only 9.2 assists on 46% from the field and 1.4 steals per game. He was number 16 over that stretch. And if we really want to like dig into this thing, we can specifically go to what he did before and after injury. Before injury, so again, up until, what did I say it was? Was that January 8th? Was that the day? So January 6th would be the game before he got hurt. That was a Saturday, by the way, just in case you were wondering. Haliburton before then was number 5 in all of fantasy sports at 24.2 points per game, 12.7 assists, 3.5 three-pointers, 1.2 steals, 0.7 blocks. That number didn't change all that much. 49.6% from the field, 87% at the free throw line. Number 5, he was behind Shea, Embiid, Jokic, and Anthony Davis. He was ahead of Luka Doncic at this point. I know. By the way, Wemby was number 16 through that point this year. Yeah, he figured it out a little bit after that. What about after that stretch? So we're going to skip over, as we're doing this analysis, we're going to skip the game where Haliburton got hurt and the one where he tried to come back too soon. And we're going to just say January 30th, basically, to the end of the year. The numbers for Haliburton, I mean, it's freaking night and day and a little bit depressing, frankly, when you think about how the season turned. From that point on, Tyrese was number 28. By the way, the minutes per game number, also notable, because the first, up to January 6th, he was playing 34 minutes per game. And after that, because of all those minutes cap games, he was at 31. So down 10% in minutes. Scoring from 24 points per game. I'm going to read these as we go. From 24 down to 17. 24 to 17. 3.5 three-pointers down to 2.3. 12.7 assists down to 9.3. 49.5% shooting to 45.5%. And even free throws came down by about 3%. He was hurt. There's almost no other way to look at it. I mean, the league played him a little bit differently, but the dude was banged up for two and a half months of the regular season. He just simply wasn't himself. So now we have to ask ourselves a really difficult question, which is, which Haliburton is coming back to start next year? I don't know about you guys, but I don't think he looks the same in the playoffs either. Is an offseason going to fix this? I'm inclined to think the answer is yes, barring Indy going and changing something large in their personnel. And you could say, okay, well, you know, Pascal Siakam came in and maybe his role shifted a little bit, but 13 down to 9, basically, an assist, the shooting completely falling off a cliff. None of it makes any sense. Some of it was Siakam, yeah. But a lot of it was just, he wasn't right. So you got some of column A, some of column B. Would I draft Haliburton in the top 5 next year? Not a chance. 5 is the best case scenario. That's with 24 points and almost 13 assists per ballgame. I don't think he's getting back to that, even if he's healthy. And that is the Siakam effect, provided, again, the personnel in Indy doesn't change all that dramatically. Is he still, in my eyes, a first-rounder? Yeah, I think so. I you know, the Haliburton we saw that was number 28, basically the second half of this year, I don't think that was real. You're probably looking at someone who exists more in the 10 to 16 range, so more of a turn type of guy with, as we've seen, some upside built in when the percentages are right and, you know, when the scoring is up and when the assists are up and all that stuff. But it does allow you a little bit of wiggle room should he not go full usage monster next year and should he defer a little bit more to fall into the middle of the second round. Because remember, when Halliburton first got traded to Indiana and they began to build around him, everybody was like, holy crap! And by the way, you should have been like, holy crap. His 26 games with Indy, he was at 17.5 points and 9.6 assists per game with 1.8 steals. It was great. He shot 50%. It was great. But he wasn't even a first rounder during that span. So usage ramped way up the following year. It was super high. It came back down when the team got another legitimate scoring threat. And so the real Slim Shady here is probably somewhere in between those two. I think there's actually a very real chance that Halliburton gets slightly overdrafted next year. I think people will be willing to overlook the second half because when it all came rolling together, he still finished at number 10 per game, and he played in 69 ball games because he wanted to qualify for awards. So he played in, you know, 22 minutes a game while he was a little bit banged up in there. And for that reason, you know, Halliburton feels like the kind of guy that people are going to be like, oh, should I go Anthony Davis or should I go Halliburton at 6/7? I probably go AD, actually, between those two guys, but it's upside hunting. I think Halliburton belongs right around 10, 11, somewhere in that range, seemingly more durable than a guy like Mitchell or Kyrie Irving, which should elevate him above that, more per-game upside than someone like a Jason Tatum, but, you know, hovering around someone like a Kevin Durant all kind of makes sense. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is your top 10. Went a little bit longer today than I expected. Thank you to the very large number of live viewers on social media. I ask you again, please go subscribe somewhere. It means the world to me because Twitter pays exactly $0 and 0 cents for me to be putting this out there. I'm pretty much only doing this on Twitter because I want to try to shuffle you guys to a different place. Because now that I'm rocking it solo, I need all of you guys to, you know, listen to the advertisements that run in between on the, you know, on Twitter or on iTunes or whatever. And if you guys really are like, hey, what's the best for you, Dan? Listening on iTunes, Spotify, something like that, those advertisements actually pay the most. So just pulling back the curtain on how a podcaster might survive in this very silly universe. Shout out to those of you that dropped a few notes on the chat room. Shining Knight, thank you very much. You're excited for this. Keep up the great work. Ash Huggins asked if we're live. Yes, ran a couple minutes late on this one. And then Andy says the logo's hilarious. The logo is hilarious. And I don't know if you guys can... Well, okay, so the folks that are watching live can see this, and I should probably try to get this into the show description. Let me make sure I get the Twitter handle right. Freaky Points is the Twitter handle of the dude Sean that put together these beyond hilarious logos. It's F-R-E-E, free is the word, key is K-E-E, and then points is spelled like the word points. So for those that are watching live, I'm going to put his Twitter handle on the screen here. You guys can see that. If you guys need logo work done, I cannot recommend that dude enough. Because every time I look at the logo for my network and for my show, I just cry tears of joy. They're amazing. Thank you again for watching, listening, everybody. Whatever, you know, however you took this in, I do appreciate it. I am Dan Bespris. This is Old Man Squad Fantasy Basketball, the flagship founding show of the Old Man Squad Sports Network. And again, go check out my buddy Joe Arrico, who just launched his show also here on the network. That's called 90 Feet From Home. It's fantasy baseball, which is happening right now, by the way. If you're playing fantasy baseball, you got to start there. I will see you all tomorrow. So long for now.